Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's grown-ups forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Diane Wilson. Diane Wilson is a licensed California marriage and family therapist. She's led support groups for Stanford University, presented at colleges and medical schools, appeared on television discussing mental health issues of people in the second half of their lives. She has 20 years of experience in a variety of settings, including, as I said, counseling, individual, family, and group, Alzheimer's and dementia assessment. She's active in case management, senior assessments, and involved in teaching and training. So let's welcome Diane Wilson.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, John. I'm going to start off with a quote. Can everybody hear me? Everyone wants to live a long life, but nobody wants to grow old. Okay. It's not easy to grow old. We want to stay healthy, vigorous, and of sound mind and body, but we all know that is not possible as we move into old age. Our bodies start to break down. We begin to forget things. Our vision is not what it used to be. And we have to ask our friends to speak louder on the telephone when we don't hear them because of all that background noise. Okay. And when it is our parents who begin to suffer the infirmities of old age, it is very hard to watch them grow old. Let me ask you a question. You can do this just by raising your hand. How many of you are caregivers now to your parents or someone else? Okay, most of you. Okay. How many of you aren't really sure if you are or not? Sometimes people really don't like the word caregiver. Okay. Caregiving can take many forms. Many of us help older, sick, or disabled family members and friends every day, but we don't think of ourselves as caregivers. We are glad to do it, at least at first, but over time we become exhausted and stressed. Many of us work outside the home and have busy family schedules, and we start to feel guilty and stressed as we get more and more tired out. How many of you can relate to getting pretty stressed out? That's right, okay. Now I'm going to give you some statistics. I hope it's not boring, but I thought you might want to know about this. Okay, it's just one paragraph. Okay, first of all, does anybody know the fastest growing age group in this country? 85 and older. Yeah, 85 and older. That's right, Judy, you are very smart. Okay, that's right. There's more than 1.5 million 85-year-olds who live alone. So think about that, you know. There are 44 million Americans, 18 and over, who provide unpaid assistance and support to older people. And by the year 2030, the number of people in this country aged 65 and older is expected to double to 70 million people. When I used to work for Avanitas, it's a senior center in Palo Alto, I found that nobody liked the word senior, so everybody was just an older adult. But think of all those older adults we're going to have by 2030. Okay, over 23 million American households are caring for older adults, and that number will grow much larger, too. And there are over 7 million long-distance caregivers in this country as well. Okay, now, this is interesting. If you were to put a dollar value to all the work you do, it would be close to $200 billion a year. Okay, so think of how much you're worth, folks. Okay, you're worth a lot, so don't forget that. Okay, So for many of us, we can no longer take our parents' health for granted. As they get older and frailer, they may no longer be able to do all the things they have always taken for granted. Depending on their health and their cognitive abilities, they may now need some assistance with activities of daily living, as well as their finances, including paying bills on time. How many of you have had seniors who forget to pay a bill? That's right. They may need help with shopping, doing errands, picking up medications, etc. Okay. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about why I'm calling it Trading Places, and I have to thank John Milford for that title. I think trading, it's not that we're always going to be our parents' children. Okay, we're always going to have that role. But as they get older and frailer, we're going to take on some of the roles that they used to do for us. So I'm going to discuss some of that. The reversal of roles. When we were young, our parents' job was to take care of us. Now, as they become frailer and are not always able to handle their activities of daily living. Does everybody know what I mean when I say activities of daily living? You know that. Great. So we may feel the need to take care of them. Of course, they may not want our help. How many of you have experienced that where our parents, you want to step in and help? I remember I said to my mom, I want to get a geriatric care manager. And I didn't use that. I just said, I have a friend who's a social worker who'd like to stop by and take you to lunch. And she said, no, I don't think so. That's really not okay. And she was 85 at that point, And then she called me back about a half hour later, and she said, Diane, I'm very angry with you. And I said, why? She said, well, because of that phone call. I said, well, I'm sorry. She said, I forgot what you said. What did you say anyway? This is true. She was mad, but she forgot why, So I said, nothing, Mom. I didn't say anything at all. I just don't even want to go there. Okay. Second, these are true stories, really. Second one is loss of support. As children, we depended on our parents for emotional and financial support. And if we were lucky, we continued to receive the emotional support from our parents as we grew into adults. Now that our parents are growing frailer, they may need our support as much as we once needed theirs. And most parents do not discuss their finances with their adult children. How many of you know you've tried to find out what their finances are and they're saying, that's none of your business? Have any of you had that experience? It's difficult to get financial information, and we feel awkward too, But the thing is, if we don't know their financial situation, we don't know what they're going to be able to afford, whether they can stay in their own home or whether they decide to move into residential care. But they're not telling us what their finances are, so it's very hard to make any plans. Okay. Another issue is the issue of mortality. Seeing our parents grow old reminds us of our own mortality. Watching our once vital parents now using a walker or not being able to drive or pay their bills is hard. And we realize we can't take our own health for granted, and that we too will one day grow old and frail, and also one day will die. How many of you think about mortality when you see your parents? It's hard not to. Right. Okay. Now I'm going to get to a fun topic, sibling rivalry. Okay. If you think it went away when you were 10 or 15, no. Okay. When our parents need our assistance, we should not have to do it alone. So it's natural for us to want our siblings to share equitably in the care of our aging parents. But having family meetings or just communications with them in person or over the phone or even by email usually brings up old rivalries and issues we thought we had long ago buried. Okay, so maybe Mom really did like you best, so maybe you want to handle the care, Or why should I forgive you for taking my best sweater and hiding it in your drawer all during high school? I never found that sweater, So how do I work with you now when I still have inner resentments or pent-up feelings I never did express? And one of the things I do in my practice is I see families and I see siblings who are trying to help plan for their parents, and I have to usually say to them first thing, we can talk about sibling rivalries, but we may only have like an hour and a half, and maybe we should put those aside because we're here really to help your parents. And you know, I say that, but sometimes it takes a few sessions for people to really put those rivalries aside. Okay. Another issue is old hurts. Not only do we have issues with our siblings, but frequently we have not quite forgiven one or both of our parents for their behaviors or attitudes that caused us pain and hurt for many years. So just when we thought we had healed, we need to help our parents in ways we couldn't have imagined years ago. I remember once talking to a gentleman who was living with his mother and doing many, many things for her. And he was doing okay, but then it got to the point where she became incontinent. And we were in a support group. And he said, you know, he said, I draw the line. That's it. I'm not changing her diapers. We're looking at assisted living. And, you know, she really needed assisted living at that point. She couldn't afford to have, you know, full-time care. And it worked out actually really well. So emotionally, we are vulnerable to our old feelings, aside from our present feelings regarding the current situation. And, you know, the past never really goes away. So I think, you know, taking care of our parents, and my mother is 90 and has Alzheimer's and lives in New York, and I'm on a plane in 2 days going to visit her. I mean, we do have to sometimes put away those old hurts if we're really going to be helping our parents. And if we find that we can't do that and we have siblings, then maybe our siblings need to play a larger role, and maybe we can play a role sort of like maybe helping with finances or insurance, but maybe not those direct roles where we feel we still hold those resentments. Okay. A big issue is confusion is rampant, okay? I mean, our parents don't stay the same. You know, they don't stay in the same condition for a long time. They may make progress in one area, like, you know, let's say they had a broken leg and it's healing and they're doing better. But then they have a setback, and now they have memory problems or a skin rash. So how many of you know it's like two steps forwards and one step back? That happens all the time, right? So you have your hands full trying to figure out what's going on. So I think when we're adult children taking care of our parents, we kind of live in a constant state of confusion and chaos. So how many of you can identify with that? That's why support groups are very helpful, because you find out other people are going through the same thing that you are. Okay. And how many of you find that you also, how many of you are doing like long distance caregiving like myself? You find you're using up those points really quickly, you know, and forget that trip to the Caribbean, you're busy visiting your mom or dad, you know. Okay. Another issue is sometimes your parents don't want your help at all. Okay. Our parents' generation went through the Depression in the 30s, which was actually much worse than the recession we're going through now, and through World War II, and their motto was, I can do it myself, okay? And they may be right, or they may be practicing the name of that great river in Africa, denial. Yeah, right. So we'll talk more about that later. Okay. Now I want to talk about emotions, and you know, so many speakers talk about seniors. There's so many things to talk about for adult children. But I think not many speakers actually get into what are the feelings that you're having. Just as the seniors themselves have a lot of, you know, mixed feelings about growing older, but you have a lot of feelings too. So let me ask you, because I want this to be an interactive talk, what are some feelings that come up for you, either positive or negative, that come up for you when you are doing caregiving for your parents?
Testing.
Hi, I'm April Holman. Frustration. My mother keeps losing her car keys, and she refuses to use a new system, like putting her keys around her neck. She keeps on trying to maintain control over how to remember her car keys. One evening she forgot her car keys 3 times within 2 hours.
I'm long distance as well. My parents are in New Jersey, and my brother and I bought my parents' cell phone just to keep with them for, you know, emergencies. They refuse to use them. They won't, you know, they can't read it, they can't hear, they can't use it, and it's very frustrating.
That's right. frustration is rampant as well as confusion, right? Anybody else?
Guilt. I'm long distance. My mom is back in New Hampshire now. My brother's there, fortunately, and taking care of just about everything. But, you know, I'm the daughter. I never had a close relationship with my mother. And so there's this, you know, she's my mother. I should be there. And there is this guilt. And all I can do is support my brother.
Sure. And I think when you talk about guilt, and I'm going to talk about that, you know, what we don't, we tend to think about what we're not doing. We don't think about all the things that we do. I'm sure if you had to, you could probably make a list of at least half a dozen things that you do for your mother. You know, we tend to feel guilty about the things we don't do, but there are many things we do. So I agree with everything that everybody said, and I'm going to go into this in a little bit more depth. For guilt and helplessness, it's easy to feel that you're not doing enough. Think of all the things you are doing, for instance, giving emotional support, handling finances, making daily phone calls, contacting their doctors, checking in with siblings and professional help. I remember one woman said she worked in the high-tech industry in Silicon Valley. She said, they don't realize that my two-hour lunches, I'm busy taking care of my mom. They don't know what I'm doing, but I have the door locked. She said, I spend just as much time sometimes doing that as I do my work. And she felt very guilty, but she said, I have to do it. There's no one else to do it. You know? So, you know, you may feel helpless when you can't fix the problem, but unlike raising children where the goal is for them to grow up and be independent one day, the sad truth is our parents will become less independent and more ill as the years progress, and we won't always be able to fix them. So it's hard to come to grips with that thought and with their failing health. And again, those issues of mortality, it's very difficult. Okay. Then there's anger and resentment. I didn't really hear anybody say anger, but when I've done support groups, I've seen some real anger. It's frustrating to do so many things required to keep your parents safe and protected. And many times they're ill, and they don't show appreciation at all. And you're taking off from work and talking to your brother long distance about that insurance claim. And so when you do get angry or upset, you know, you need to step back and take a break, okay? You really need to walk away, take a walk, talk to your friend, talk to a therapist, you know, whatever you need to do, but just realize that they can't help themselves either. I think in this situation, remember, we're all doing the best we can, and there's no easy footprint for this. I think I once gave a talk where I looked up some information. In 1900, the average age for people to die was the age of 47. Okay, now it's something like 74, and many people are living much longer than that. And the question is, what's the quality of life? So, you know, we're seeing people living to their 90s, but the quality of life is not always very good. You know, and we're taking care of them. It's really hard. Okay. The other issue I want to mention is sorrow and grief. It's hard to come to grips with the fact that you're losing your parent. Sometimes it's just a little bit at a time, but sometimes it could be a crisis, okay, and it happens much faster than that. I remember I was close to my grandmother many, many years ago. I was about 20, and she was just wonderful, and we used to go to movies, and I think she was 80-something. I just loved her. She was wonderful. And then one day she had a stroke. She lost her ability to speak. She couldn't move. She was in a wheelchair, and I went to see her. And it's embarrassing to admit it, but I didn't want to see her after that. I was still kind of a young 20, and I felt like, this can't be my grandma. This can't be the grandmother who I did everything with. I always think when somebody say, what was one of the reasons you went into the field, I think it was always because, and she died about a year later, I always felt I didn't have that relationship. I should have gone to see her more, but I didn't. It was too hard for me to think that this could possibly be the grandmother that I had. I was so close to, you know. So I think you need to allow yourself time to grieve. Don't be surprised. I don't know if any of you ever found yourself crying at the supermarket or having trouble focusing at work or even on a night out with friends. I had somebody in my support group once say, I love seeing my friends, but, you know, they don't want to hear anymore. I can't talk to them anymore. about what I'm doing. And therefore, that's why I come to the support group, because it's really important that you understand, but a lot of people don't. And my uncle died, and my father died when I was a little girl, so my uncle kind of took over the role of father. And he died in 2003. And about 5 years later, I was driving in a road in Palo Alto where I used to work, and I saw a Chevrolet Impala. Now, my uncle was a salesman, and he used to get Chevys every 2 years, and I used to go to the showroom with him, and it was so exciting to sit in the car with him when I was a kid. So I had to follow this Chevrolet Impala for about 2 miles, you know, down like Sand Hill Road in Palo Alto. And I was going to work, and I was a manager at Avanitas. By the time I got to work, I was a puddle. I just had tears rolling down my face because I kept thinking of my uncle and how much I missed him. And I had no idea I was even thinking about him until I suddenly realized my face was all wet. So, you know, that was 5 years after he died, so I was still grieving. So recognize there's a lot of grief involved, you know. Grief is all-encompassing, and it will interfere with your own abilities. So don't try to do this alone. Again, you know, call a friend, a therapist, join a support group, but just recognize that you shouldn't have to do this alone. Get some help, okay. Another area I want to talk about briefly is depression. There's a big difference between depression and just grief. I know that there's a psychologist or a couple of psychologists in the audience, so you know about this. But, you know, grief and sorrow does lessen after a while. But clinical depression is an illness that does not go away without professional help, okay? Some symptoms include feelings of extreme sadness, waves of apathy and hopelessness, changes in eating and sleeping habits, trouble concentrating, irritability and teary bouts, and even thoughts about suicide. So, and they last at least 2 weeks and many times over 2 months and much longer. So if you're experiencing these, please see a doctor, psychiatrist, or therapist for an evaluation. Don't hesitate to get help. And I've read statistics that say that live-in caregivers have twice the rate of depression of people who are not doing caregiving or not living in. So. So now that I've depressed you all, hopefully not, I want to talk about some strategies. What are some strategies for helping yourselves and your loved ones at this time? Well, I think one of the best things to do and how many of you are just at the beginning stage of caregiving where you're really not sure what the heck you're doing? Okay, well, then I'm talking to you, but how many of you are in the middle stage? Okay, then. Right. But this can actually happen anytime, but it's really good in the beginning is to call a family meeting, okay? So it's best not to try to do the caregiving by yourself. If you have siblings, this is the first sign that your parents need more help to remain independent. I would call a family meeting and use a facilitator. Get as many people as you can in the room. And that's what I find. If you just have, like, let's say you have a sister and a brother and then another brother who lives far away. And let's say the sister and the brother come, but the brother who lives in Alaska said, tell me what you talked about. Well, the brother in Alaska is never going to buy into whatever you've decided because he was not a stakeholder. He was not involved. So what I try to do is say, if the brother from Alaska can't come, maybe we could do a conference call. And I've done that. I mean, it can be a little tricky, but it's really good to get everyone in the room or on the phone who's involved. Not even by email, because, you know, email is cold. You can give a summary of what you talked about, but that, in other words, try to get everybody involved. And everybody has a right to state their opinions, particularly in the beginning where, again, the sibling rivalry, but everyone's going to have a different view of what went on. And so it's good for either the facilitator or the person who called the meeting to get some medical records so that if you said, well, mom had 3 strokes, and your brother said, no, she had 2, you know, not that it's that important, but make sure you at least have the facts because that's important. Talk about finances and health care wishes. And many times people say to me, well, should the parents be present? It's up to you. If the parents are cognizant and doing well and they want to be present, okay. But I would say many times if you have concerns, the first meeting maybe don't have the parents. You can have the parents at the second meeting. But the first meeting, sometimes the siblings, you just want to talk about what's going on without your parents present. You just want to be able to say whatever you have to say. But you do want to make sure that somewhere along the line they have a durable power of attorney for finances and have completed an advanced health care directive. Encourage them strongly to do both so they decide now who they want to help make important decisions for them in the future. Because, you know, when they don't no longer have capacity, it's too late to do that. I remember with my mom, I love her, but she's very stubborn. I'm sure I'd take after her a little bit. But anyway, but she, you know, my brother is an attorney, and so he did, you know, these papers and everything, and he's particularly the advanced health care, and he showed it to her, and she said, I'm not signing it. It's too complicated. This was many years ago, very early stage dementia. So my brother went back and he simplified it, and I said, you know, let's take it to my two aunts, my father's sisters, who she liked, you know. So we took her over to my father's sisters and everything, and they were prepared. They came out with their own, healthcare directive, and said, look, we've done this, Rosalind. You know, this is what you need to do. And she said, no, I don't think so. So she's stubborn. Finally, my brother and I said, well, Mom, if you don't do this now and you go into the hospital, two doctors, strangers, are going to decide your future. And my aunt said, you're right, that's it. So she said, okay, I'm signing, you know. So sometimes you have to strategize a little bit about, you know, what you're going to say and how you're going to do it. But it's really important to make sure that these are done early on in the caregiving process, even before they're sick, much before. Okay. So about the meeting, coming back to the meeting, go slowly and include your parents' thoughts and feelings as much as possible. Remember, this is their lives you're talking about, you know, not yours. I mean, you may come up with the best plan in the world. Here's what I think, and all your siblings may agree, which would be amazing. But you bring it to your parents, and they say, I don't think so. And my experience is if both of your parents are alive, they'll collude. Each one will protect the other. And so it's really important to, in that case, and I have had meetings, bring everybody in, including the parents, and realize it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, it may take them a few months to decide to finally do this, but it's good to work with a professional if you can. Take advantage of community resources. You know, San Francisco Bay Area is fantastic. I mean, we don't live in a small town somewhere in Iowa. We are very lucky to have so many community resources. So find out about Meals on Wheels and maybe an adult day program. And there's lots of resources. My website, agewisecounseling.com, has a whole list of resources in the Bay Area. There's a lot. And a lot of websites you can go to that are free, like Family Caregiver Alliance. And just all, there's so many. I think I know that one. Right? Lots of things that you can, like, for instance, Family Caregiver Alliance, I believe you can get a half hour. Diane Levant, can you still get a half hour of free services with an attorney? Yeah, I think you can. Like, things like that, you can get. Okay. Yeah, so Family Caregiver Alliance is one agency in the city that does wonderful things for caregivers at either nominal fee or even free. Also, they have about 50 fact sheets, which are really helpful. Yeah. Lastly, I think this is important if with your siblings, agree to disagree, okay, especially in the first meeting. Everyone has different perceptions and feelings about their parents, and your siblings may need to vent a little bit, okay, before they're ready to agree to a plan that involves compromises and changes in your parents' lives. Sometimes all of us are in denial when it comes to facing our parents' decline. I mean, for years I was saying to my brother, you know, Joel, Mom has dementia. You know, she's got dementia. No, just a little bit of memory loss. And just, you know, and it took years until she was actually admitted to the hospital and then, you know, neurologist checked her out and said, your mother has dementia. My brother said, oh, you're right, you know. But it took years for my brother to accept that. He just didn't want to accept that she really had it. So another strategy here is setting limits, okay? Get rid of that little voice that says, I can do it all, okay? Ask yourself, what can I reasonably do myself, and what do I need help with? That's really important because some people just want to be martyrs and they want to do it themselves. How many of you have problems asking for help? This is a great group, or just a few. Okay, but most of you, how many of you do ask for help? How many of you actually receive the help you ask for? Okay. You know, and many times I have to say this. I used to work for Adult Protective Services in San Mateo County, and many times we would get calls, you know, APS would get calls because the neighbors called. Because I had one woman call, and she said, I'm so sorry to call, but, you know, the kids live far away, and I take out their garbage, you know, and I do this, and I pick up medications for them. And, you know, she had a list of six things she did, of course, you know, no charge. And she said, and I'm going away for 2 weeks, and the kids don't want to do anything, and how can I leave this couple when they have so many needs? And please, APS, go out and check it out. And I said, and she felt really guilty, you know, about calling. I said, well, look at all the wonderful things you're doing for your neighbor. And of course we'll check it out. And of course we'll also contact the adult children and say, hello, your parents need a little more help than just the neighbors, who are very nice. But that's not, the neighbors are not the solution to all the help, you know. Another thing is to examine your motivation, okay? You know, this is not something conscious. I think this is something unconscious. But if you expect a lot of praise, respect, or love, you know, oh, I love you and thank you so much for doing this, you know, it doesn't usually work, okay? Sometimes you feel like you have to pay back your parents for what they did for you. And you know, you really don't have to pay them back. I mean, they chose to be parents. And so, I mean, we want to help them, sure. I remember once a lady in my support group, her mother lived in Florida and she lived in Palo Alto, and she'd been helping for years, and there were siblings in Florida, and she just came in 1 month. We did the group monthly. She came in 1 month and she said, that's it, I'm done. She said, I've been doing this for 6 years. She's now in assisted living or somewhere, and you know what? I'm done. I don't even want to get emails from my siblings. I'm finished. And everybody went, yay! You know, it's like because they knew her really well. They knew she had done so much. And she never had a good relationship with her mom, and she never was able to really heal it. And she just said, I'm finished. And, you know, I think that may be a hard concept to imagine because I always want to keep helping. But I think it's okay sometimes when you say you're done, as long as she was well taken care of. So I think we have to, you know, have to recognize that sometimes it's okay when you're done, you're done. You know? How many of you might have an old tape in your head that says, good girls or good boys have to take care of their parents? You know I have that. I was raised that way, you know. Well, that tape wore out a long time ago, just like your Bee Gees cassette from 1985. You know, it's kind of over. You know, it's like, you know, it's not that we shouldn't take care of our parents, but it's the word should. I want to say should. Hopefully we do it because we want to, not because we feel obligated to do this. So examine your motivation and find out, am I doing too much because I feel I absolutely have to, or maybe I can bring in some help here. Yeah. Okay. Another big issue is to separate your own anxiety from the real demands of the situation. I had a couple come see me once in a lot of people, I think in Palo Alto, their parents were in Florida. But their mom was in Florida. Their father, it was the husband. The husband's mom was in Florida. His father had died about 3-4 months before. And mom was doing really well. She had a whole group of friends. She was very active. She still drove. She was in her 80s. Cognitively, she was sharp as a tack. You know, everything was going well. And this couple came in, and the husband said, I want to bring mom here. And the wife said, I'm not so sure. Mom seems to be doing okay in Florida. And so they said, Diane, you're the expert. I said, well, let's just see what we can talk about. Anyway, we talked about it for about an hour. And what I was able to say to them is, I think this is your anxiety. Mom seems to be doing, does mom want to come to San Francisco or Palo Alto? No, mom wants to stay in Florida. She has a flourishing support group there, and she's doing very well. So whose anxiety is this? And finally the man said, yeah, it's mine. I feel like I should. Because my dad died, I should bring her here. And I said, there are no shoulds. You know, the right thing is what your mom wants to do. And, you know, so they were really appreciative. I remember they said, wow, you gave us permission to just let her live her life, which is important. We always think we have to step in, but we don't. Okay. Another strategy is I'm sure people say this to you all the time, but it's truly important, is schedule time away just for you. You know, everybody needs time to just veg or get a massage or read that trashy novel you wanted to read, you know, sit on the beach. We all need times away from our loved ones just to recharge our batteries. If you don't do that, one day your battery will die, and you'll be the one needing help. So, you know, I hate to say it, but many caregivers, this is particularly in the spouse situation, many caregivers actually die before the one who's ill because they're so busy taking care of the spouse and not giving themselves any break. So, okay. Another thing is let go of futile efforts. If your parent is mentally competent and refuses help consistently, he or she has the right to make bad choices. In social work parlance, it's called the right to folly. I love that, the right to folly. I remember my brother calling me a few years ago to tell me my very proper mother, who would never allow me to talk to strangers in New York, certainly not get into a stranger's car. Well, she was now hitching rides from total strangers in New York. Hitching rides, you know. That's when I realized for sure my mom's lost it. She's lost it. She has dementia. And she was diagnosed shortly afterwards with dementia. But she thought it was the fastest and cheapest way to buy a newspaper since she could no longer drive her car. This is true, I know. And you know, I said to her, Mom, you know, not such a good idea here. Really, this is not a good idea. And she said, what does somebody want with an old lady? I said, probably not you personally, but your purse. Except in New York, it's called your pocketbook. I said, your pocketbook, Mom, you know, you got stuff in there somebody might want. She said, oh, forget it, you know. But what we did is we figured out we could have the newspaper delivered. So, you know, that's, I immediately got on the phone to my brother and we said, yeah, let's get the paper delivered. So, but, you know, to her, it made perfect sense. Why should she said, why should I pay for a taxi when a newspaper is only like a dollar? It would cost me too much money. I said, we'll work it out, Mom. You know, so, you know, that's when I also realized that the relationship with my mother would never be the same. When you have something like that happen, you realize, yeah, she's really losing it. I remember another time she called me to say, she said, Diane, you have a house in San Francisco, don't you? I said, yes. She said, I have wonderful news for you. She said, I'm going to get you another house. I said, why? You know, this is before she was even diagnosed. I said, what do you mean, Mom? She said, well, she said, what was it, Publishers? No, it wasn't Publishers. It was New York. It was Time Magazine. She said, Time Magazine just told me that, you know, I want a house for you. I want a house. And she said, I already have one, so I'm going to give you a second house. I said, Mom, did Time Magazine call you? She said, no, but it says right here, if I fill this out, that I'm going to win a house. And she wouldn't listen to me when I told her she wasn't really winning the house. But my brother, who's an attorney, and he's the, you know, the smart one in the family, my brother called her and said, Mom, you have a chance of winning a house, about one in, you know, 10 million or something. So she said, well, if I win it, I'm going to give it to you. I said, thank you very much. So, yeah. Okay, so if you don't know if your parent is mentally competent, you can do a couple of things. You could call Adult Protective Services in your county. They'll do just a quick cognitive screening, and I'll tell you that APS is so busy these days that it may not necessarily be the best way to go. Again, you can look at my website to get a list of resources in the area that do a full battery of testing to determine your parents' cognitive capacity. Leslie Stafford here is the person who did my website. And Leslie, I remember you put in all those links. I think it's UCSF. I think it's Stanford. Stanford actually has a great system. They actually do some free testing. And also, if you're away in the East Bay, like Sacramento, then Davis Medical Center does a complete neuropsych battery, and they do blood tests, and they do big workups. But it's not very easy. Like, the thing about Stanford that drove me crazy when I worked in Palo Alto was that if you recommend somebody go for the battery, you know, it's okay, except when your parents walk in the door and the sign says, Alzheimer's testing. Why don't they just say memory testing, you know? Because I've had comments like, my mom wouldn't walk through that door. I said, I know what you're saying, but they won't change it. Last point I want to make is learn how to say no. I just recently turned, I'll just say it, an aught number, you know, an age, and I said, this is my time. I'm learning the decade. My husband's here, right, Michael? I'm learning how to say no. learning how to say no. I used to always say yes to everything. I have two children, my mom, and other responsibilities, but I'm learning how to say no because it's the only way to stay sane. You know, you can't say yes to everything. So if your parent says, only you can pick up the medications, or you can comb my hair, or you can handle my finances, it's really okay to say no. Don't be a martyr if you know that you're stretched as far as you can go. Discuss with your parent and family an alternative solution to the problem. Maybe a friend or a neighbor can help out, a sibling, if they're still talking to you, you know, can handle the finances. Or maybe you could just get some professional help. We have so many services in San Francisco. How many of you know about the 311 number? You can call up and just find out about a lot of services, and it's free. And stick to your plan regardless of pressure from your family or friends or anybody. Your goal is to keep your parent safe and keep your sanity too. Okay? So that's basically what I wanted to say, and I wanted to open it up to questions.
Diane, we'd like to remind our listening audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Trading Places, How to Cope When the Adult Child is Caring for the Parent, with Diane Wilson. Diane, questions?
Does anybody have any questions you'd like to ask? I'll try to answer. The 311 number? Basically, 311 number is for services. It's social work services, I believe, in San Francisco. So if you know anybody who has any questions about types of services, they can just call 311, and there should be an operator. I'm not sure the hours, maybe like 8 to 5, but somebody should be able to answer questions. Maybe you want to know about, are there senior centers in the area? Is there an adult day center, Meals on Wheels? I'm sorry?
We use the microphone
For San Francisco.
For the broadcast, please.
I believe there are other social workers and psychologists. I believe it's just for San Francisco, 311, right? And there's also a 21. Is there a 211 number too? I'm not sure. Anyway, I know there's a 311. Yeah.
So for decades, a couple of decades now, my mother has always been prepared for assisted living. She's had discussions with us and said, oh, I like this place and I like this place. This summer she was diagnosed with Lewy body dementia, and the decline has been fairly dramatic. She's got sitters at home, but my sister and I are realizing that an assisted living center is going to come much sooner, I think, than she is ready for now. What are some of the tips in beginning to introduce that idea when the person, she's not necessarily completely opposed, but it's not on her schedule now? What are some of the tips about discussing that?
Well, I think one thing to do is maybe a lot of these places will do like a free luncheon, and maybe ask her if she'd like to go out for lunch and take her to lunch at some of these places, and just, you know, maybe have a list of two or three places and take maybe one a week, you know, something like that, and just talk to her about, and maybe also, you know, give her a tour and show her the facilities and find out what she's still able to do, what her interests are. So, for instance, if she can still play bridge, maybe they have a bridge club and you can find out about it. So find out what she likes to do. Mary Kay, you had some ideas? No, go ahead. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just had a quick question. What is the basic difference between dementia and Alzheimer's?
Okay, it's a good question. Dementia is the broad umbrella term. Dementia, there's about 50 different types of dementia. Alzheimer's is one type of dementia. It's the most prevalent in people 60 and over, but it's actually only one type. There are actually types of dementia that can be reversed. For instance, if you have a vitamin B12 deficiency, those types of dementias can actually be reversed, but Alzheimer's cannot. And Alzheimer's also is like doubling. More and more people are getting Alzheimer's these days. But it's only one type of dementia.
What happens if you have a one parent who wants to move into a continuum and the other who wants to stay where they are and age in place?
Okay. Well, do they both have capacity?
Yes.
It's challenging. I mean, I think in that case, I don't think I could really give you a blanket answer. I think what I'd say is I would really want to meet both of them and find out what the objection is from, let's say, for instance, if it's your father, the father who doesn't want to move.
How did you know it was my father?
Because it usually, that was my experience. I mean, I remember a case, I had a case like that when I worked in Palo Alto. And what finally happened is mom had dementia. And so they finally agreed to move in, but father insisted that they were fortunately really a people of means, so they did not have to sell their house. They kept the house, and the father went home about at least 1 or 2 days a week. He could still drive. He went home occasionally just to sort of check the mail, check the house. And so the feeling was, he had the feeling, I can still move back if I want to. And but he noticed his wife made incredible progress in the assisted living facility. They had a wonderful dementia unit. And he was actually pleased with how well she did. And he stayed with her about 5 or 6 nights a week. And eventually he got ill. He got really sick. And so after that, finally, the adult children finally did decide to sell the house when he was too ill to go back to the house. But, you know, when he was well, the fact that he could go visit the house meant so much to him. He liked gardening and certain things. He just liked being home and checking on the house. So that was one solution. But again, I think every solution is different depending on what the situation is.
I'd like to hitchhike on your response to that.
Sure.
Sometimes you said they both were cognitively high-functioning. Then maybe there's something behind what they want. Maybe they need time apart. So if that's the case, she can go in or he can go in for a temporary stay and see how they actually do apart. I've had people who come to me and say, we want to go, but we don't want to be in the same building. So we have to listen to what they are saying behind just what they're saying.
I just want to say this is Mary Kay Stegner of Stegner Registry, and welcome, Mary Kay. So.
So this one ties to family. Sisters who think that it's just great to lie to mom constantly. Another sister, me, who says, I'm not sure about the line between telling the truth and lying. And the lying is largely to control information. Dementia is increasing, and we know that at some point you just go along. So it's very hard to determine, and what are your tidbits on when's it okay to lie and when's it okay to tell it straight? How do we decide? Because we're really in conflict about it.
It's a tough question. You know, it's kind of, I was kind of raised with the golden rule. Not to lie, but, you know, there are gray areas sometimes with seniors. I personally, what I would want to do, if it's possible to get everybody in the same room, is call a family meeting. I would really want to do that. I would want to find out what's the motivation. Obviously, your sisters think that this is a good idea. You know, they're not trying to hurt your mother in any way. They obviously have reasons. Probably they just don't want to explain everything to your mom. They just want it done a certain way. But I would, but obviously, you know, you have your feelings about why that doesn't work for you. So I would want to put everybody in the same room and see if you can hash it out and see what they're refusing, you know, what they will not change about and what they feel that maybe they can tell the truth. I mean, sometimes telling your parents the truth, it's not nearly as bad as what you thought. I mean, you know, and I mean, but it's a complicated situation. There's no one answer for it.
Diane, are you aware of any place locally or in the state where they offer the nighttime alternative to adult daycare? Because so many people with dementia are active at night, and that's what wrecks it for people who have them at home and are trying to work and keep track of somebody that's up all night into things and all that. I'm aware that there are places in the country that have adult night programs.
There are. That's right.
Where you drop somebody off after dinner and then you pick them up in the morning. But is there anything like that in California, or does California even allow that?
I don't know the rules and regulations. I just know there's a blog, the New York Times blog called The New Old Age. Okay, and that's on my resource list. It's a wonderful blog. You can look at it online. And I don't remember what state. It might have been Florida. There's so many older people in Florida, but have it. But I'm not aware of California having it, or particularly the Bay Area. But Mary Kay, you know?
It's not against regulations, if that's your question, John. It's not against regulations for if someone wanted to do it. I think there's a danger in that, and I don't know how. Is it New York that has, solved the solution? Because, they're up during the night. I assume you're talking about sundowners primarily. They're up during the night, and then they pick them up in the morning. Now, you've got a caregiver problem here because they have to sleep. Okay, so that means you're just reversing night, day. It doesn't really slow the progression of sundowners down. You know this. But to my knowledge, there are no night programs registered in the state of California, mm-hmm. but there are no regulations that would prevent it. That's a good profession for some of you. There mm-hmm. you go.
Anyone want to talk about the emotional aspects of caregiving or family meetings or any problems they're having with their siblings or, some of the things we talked about in my talk? Yes, this lady.
My mom and my brother are back in New Hampshire. My mom had to be moved from Massachusetts to New Hampshire. And I don't know whose advice it came from, but someone told my brother that he should get an elder care attorney because of the differences in laws between the states and also in finding out what are all the legal things that need to be done, because she's reached a point where her financial situation is, finances are being depleted, mm-hmm. and when can she go on Medicare? There are things like that you have to think about. Mm-hmm. And that woman back in Massachusetts has just been wonderful. She's told us what we did wrong in a couple of situations, mm-hmm. but also how to correct the things we did wrong and how to go mm-hmm. on from here.
She's a geriatric care manager?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't mention geriatric care managers, but they're wonderful.
I don't think she's the care manager. She's the legal person. She has recommended someone who could be a care manager.
Okay, elder law attorney.
If we need it, yes.
She's an elder law. Elder law attorneys yes. also, I really have worked with them, and I appreciate everything they do. They know the laws, and that's so important to me. And many times people ask me legal questions, and I really say, you really have to go to an elder law attorney, because the laws are very complicated, certainly from state to state. But even in this state of California, they're pretty complicated. So I would always, so if I'm not sure, I always say consult with an elder law attorney.
I just wanted to reinforce what you said about giving yourself permission to let go, because as you probably know, recently my mother moved from Southern California to Texas, where when she was in Southern California, I was totally responsible for her. Now she's in Texas, surrounded by the rest of my family. And I'm finding although I'm relieved that I'm no longer the one that's, immediately responsible for everything, I almost find things to get myself involved in that I really don't need to and cause myself stress, because I haven't yet totally given up the fact that I'm no longer responsible.
Sure. And you might want to go visit her too and see how she's adjusting. But it's true. I mean, many times, it becomes our life and our lifestyle to be taken care of. I still call my mom almost every night, just because I've done that since I'm a kid, since my father died when I was little. And we just got, my brother and I got in the habit of calling, so I still call her a lot. And when she was in a nursing home recovering from an operation, and I couldn't get to her because maybe she was asleep or the phone wasn't hooked up, I was very distressed that I couldn't talk to her, even though she was probably happy to be asleep. But, you know, it's like we so much get into certain patterns of doing things, and we have to recognize sometimes we do have to pull back. And they might do very well without all our interventions.
One other comment, and this is what this meeting is all about, is education. I feel that the better educated we all are, then the better decisions that we can help our parents make. Education about the terminology you use. We just had this discussion, 2.5, 3 weeks ago. You don't tell your parents you're doing things for them. You're doing things with them. So little things like that for caregivers and for children. You want to comment about that, Diane, because it's really education.
I think you said it very well, really. I mean, there's education. I mean, I've been in the field about 20 years, and I still try to attend as many workshops as I can so that I know more about it in my own situation, but certainly to help others. I think we can always, you know, continue to learn. And I think education is wonderful. I also think support. I'm also a big proponent of support groups because I think that in support groups, people educate each other. You know, someone says, oh, do you know about this program, so-and-so? And, oh, I didn't know anything about that. So you learn a lot sometimes in groups, things like that.
How about the problem of the reluctant caregiver when there is no one else and there are the feelings of being tied down and loss of freedom and all those kind of things?
I think that's a very, very common situation to feel reluctant, particularly if there's nobody else. I think it's difficult. I think it's really important to get support. I think this is where a therapist could be very helpful, therapist or social worker who could really work through kind of what I talked about, what is absolutely necessary for you to do and what you can delegate. It's important to find out what you can delegate, and usually you can delegate a lot more than you think, but it's about letting go also. I mean, sometimes in the beginning, it's not easy to let go. You really do have to come up with a plan, especially if there's a crisis. You know, you do have to be actively involved. But usually after a while, you can let go. So, but it's finding the right resources so that, as I said to my mother's caregiver, I said, Anita, I said, I've gotten religious. I didn't used to be. I said, but I pray for you every night. Thank you.
Diane, unfortunately, our time is gone. We want to thank our speaker, Diane Wilson, tonight for being on our program. Thank you, Diane. Thank you. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.
Thank you very much. Thank you.